From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Insects and Amber by Tom Ramey. The storm built in the southwest, turning the air to underwater blue, making the flat land look like the bottom of the sea. Lightning flickered in the approaching darkness and threw fleeting shimmers on the rolling clouds. Thunder that had been distant rumbles soon crackled across the Kansas prairie unhindered. Tanny and I watched the spectacular display through the rear window of the new Buick station wagon. The rain followed us like a vague mile-long curtain. It caught us in minutes and turned the late afternoon to night. My father grunted and flipped on the lights and windshield wipers. He braked the station wagon carefully and hunched over the steering wheel, peering into the downpour. Thunder crashed and rattled around us. The lightning flashes were so brilliant that they left a white streak floating before our eyes. The windshield wipers snicked away merrily but futilely. Tanny sat beside me, bright-eyed with excitement. She was 7 and had one of those inquisitive minds that drove certain adults up the wall. We were starting out on one of those vacations the auto manufacturers, the motel owners, the resort owners, the tire companies, Howard Johnson's, and the curio sellers on Route 66 like to promote. We had piled into the station wagon for 3 weeks of butt-numbing travel. We left Lubbock that morning. My father was an associate professor of English at Texas Tech, planning to go up through Kansas, Nebraska, South Dakota, over to Wyoming and Yellowstone, then back to Colorado and home. It wasn't the kind of vacation I would have initiated, though I didn't mind it that much. I was 15, not too far from 16, and if given a guilt-free choice, I would have probably stayed in Lubbock to goof around with my friends. But since I had a special relationship with my family, the trip was no sacrifice. We had planned to make it to Dodge City by nightfall, but the rain seemed to have put the kibosh on that. Dad was creeping along about 20 miles an hour, barely able to see the road, and went like that for a while until we came up behind a couple of other cars going even slower. We're behind a red Firebird with Arizona plates, and it was behind an old pickup truck. Dad didn't try to pass, and the Firebird seemed content to stay where it was, too. Mom squinted at an Exxon roadmap. "The next town is Holly, but it looks pretty small," she said. "It's an open circle, which means..." She shuffled the map. "Under 1,000. Let's hope it's not too small to have a motel," Dad said, giving up on Dodge City. "I don't care about a motel," Tanny chirped. "I just hope there's some place to eat." She sat with her nose pressed against the window, fogging up the glass with her breath and then drawing pictures in it. "Eat?" I laughed. "You've eaten enough today to kill a horse." I knew she really was hungry, but she liked me to tease her. Tanny turned from the window and surveyed me coolly, but with a twinkle in her eye. I knew she was about to devastate me. She leaned back in the seat and crossed her arms. "There's a little too much sibling rivalry in this seat," she said with an ultra-ladylike air. I groaned. She was always saying something like that. Mom and Dad laughed. I could see Tanny's mouth beginning to twitch. She wouldn't be able to hold that lofty expression very long. "It's your own fault, Ben," Dad chuckled. "You should never have told her she was precocious." "Yeah," Tanny grinned. "I looked it up." "Uh-oh," Dad said. He stopped laughing and slowed the station wagon. I leaned on the back of the front seat and looked over Mom's shoulder. Wooden barricades with amber flashers were in the road ahead. Two cars were already stopped, a yellow Volkswagen and a dark, sedate sedan that may have been a Chevrolet. The pickup stopped behind the sedan, the Firebird stopped behind the pickup, and we stopped behind the Firebird. Everyone sat there for a bit in a neck craning session. Then a man in a raincoat got out of the passenger side of the VW. He hurried around to the driver's side of the sedan, apparently intending to get in without comment, but the guy in the pickup truck stuck his head out the window and said something. The man in the raincoat hesitated, rather reluctantly. I thought, then came back to the pickup and stood there talking. "Guess I'd better get out and see what's going on," Dad said with a resigned sigh. "Charles, you're gonna get soaked." Dad twisted around the seat. "Ben, can you get to the umbrella back there?" I got on my knees in the seat and dug around the back among the suitcases, blankets, cardboard boxes full of who knows what and all kinds of vacation gear. I finally found it and handed it to him. As Dad got out in the rain, a girl got out of the VW, also with an umbrella. They met at the pickup. Then a guy got out of the Firebird and joined them. It was turning into a convention. They stood there in the pouring rain, all four of them, talking and waving their arms and pointing this way and that. Mostly it was the man from the sedan and the guy in the pickup. He was the smart one. He was in and out of the rain. Then after a while it dispersed. "We gotta take a detour," Dad said when he got back in. "What's wrong?" Mom asked. "Highway's underwater up ahead." "Could you see it?" Tanny perked up at the first sign of disaster. "No," the girl in the VW said a highway patrolman in a yellow slicker told her the road was flooded. He stopped her, and then the old gentleman in the sedan came along. Seems they know each other. "Did he say the detour was safe?" Mom asked, looking at the rain with a little frown. "I don't know. The patrolman seems to have disappeared. The guy in the pickup lives around here. He said it was okay." Tanny bounced in the seat. "Isn't this exciting?" she squeaked. "You won't think so if we have to spend the night in the car stuck in the mud somewhere," I said. Dad grimaced. "Hold that thought, cheerful Charlie," he said, and started the motor. The sedan pulled around the VW and turned left onto a gravel road that cut off the highway at the barricades. The VW followed him, then the pickup, then the Firebird, and then us, just like a camel caravan. The road wasn't bad, a little rough with lots of standing puddles. I turned around the seat and looked back at the highway, but I couldn't see the flashers anymore. We must have gone over a rise, although I hadn't noticed doing so. I also thought I saw the headlights of a car go by on the highway, but with the rain, I wasn't sure. It must have been lightning. Mom and Dad didn't talk. The farther we traveled from the highway, the darker it seemed to get. Mom watched the road nervously, and Dad kept his attention on his driving. Even Tanny was quiet for a change. She had her nose against the window again, trying to see by the frequent flashes of lightning. I don't know how far we had gone. It probably seemed further than it was because we were moving so slowly. Then I pressed my nose against the window and looked out. I don't know if it was coincidence or not, but it couldn't have been better if it had been staged by Alfred Hitchcock. There was a tremendous rattle of thunder and a flash of lightning that lingered for an unaccountably long time. I saw a house some 50 yards from the road on top of a low hill. It looked quite old, a big boxy shape with lots of tall chimneys and gables and a tower on one corner. The lightning faded slowly, and I turned my head to follow it, but the lightning wasn't repeated. I turned as Dad braked the station wagon to a stop. The other cars in the caravan were stopped also, their brake lights flicking on and off. "You think somebody got stuck in the mud?" Tanny asked with a faint current of desire under the question. I think she would gladly be attacked by tigers just to find out what it was like. "Let's hope not," Dad grunted. Somebody up the row honked his horn. "Looks like they're calling another conference," I said. "Looks like you're right," Dad pulled out the umbrella. I leaned my arms in the back of the seat and watched them gather around the pickup truck again. Then the rain slacked or something, and I could see by the headlights of the sedan a sheet of muddy water flowing across the road. Trash and debris swirled around on it, weeds and tree limbs. After a bit, they disbanded, and Dad got back in, wrestling with the umbrella. "This road is flooded too," he said in a discouraged voice. "We'll have to turn around and go back." "Doesn't look like there's room to turn around. You might get stuck in the ditch," Mom said matter-of-factly. She was worried but wouldn't show it. She didn't want to frighten Tammy and me. According to the guy in the pickup, we just passed, quote, the old Weatherly place, unquote. We're supposed to back up and turn around in the drive. Yeah, I said. I saw it. Looked like something out of a horror movie. Terrific, Dad groaned. I want to see, Tanny squealed and scrambled on top of me, pasting her face against the damply cool window. Watch it, I grunted. You've got bony knees. Okay, hold it down back there, Dad said, but he was smiling. He backed the car slowly, looking over his shoulder. Can you see where you're going? Mom asked. Actually, no, he grimaced. Dad had it the worst. The others could see by the headlights of the car behind them. Tanny and I had our noses against the window again, watching for the house. A flash of lightning came right on cue. Tanny let out a little sigh of appreciation. Dad stopped the station wagon with a lurch. Brake lights flashed on sequentially down the row. Dad raised up in the seat and examined the drive critically with a little frown on his face. A culvert crossed a ditch of rushing water, though more water seemed to be going over the drive than under it. He looked at Mom. She looked at the water. Dad shrugged, rippled a tattoo on the steering wheel with his fingernails, and pulled slowly in. The front end had nosed in about 3 feet when it lurched suddenly sideways and slipped into the ditch. Are we stuck in the mud? Tanny asked with cloying innocence. I wouldn't be at all surprised. Dad put the station wagon in reverse and tried to back out. The tires whined in the car and slithered further into the road. Dad cut the engine and settled back in the seat with a snort. Looks like it's time for another conference, I said when I saw the others converging on us. Don't be a wiseacre, he groaned. He grabbed the umbrella and got out. I scooted over to the other side and rolled down the window so I could hear. Sorry, folks, Dad said. Tough luck, Mr. Henderson. That was the guy from the Firebird. They had apparently introduced themselves at a previous conference. The girl in the yellow Volkswagen was Ann Callahan. She was 20 and absolutely lovely. That was the first time I'd had a good look at her. When I did, I couldn't keep my eyes off her. The old guy in the sedan was Professor Philip Weatherly. That's right, Weatherly as in the old Weatherly place. He was 60 with a kindly but slightly befuddled expression. I also caught inadvertently a certain amount of nervous strain, but I didn't think much about it under the circumstances. Carl Willingham was a driver of the pickup. He was about 50 with a slightly protuberant beer belly and a cigar that he worried about in his mouth. He was wearing boots and a sweat-darkened Stetson, I think, had been sent over by Central Casting. The guy from the Firebird was Poe McNeil. He was about 25 with a cheerful face and a quick smile. He had a stocky, muscular build and a pleasant rather than handsome face. I liked him immediately. Ann Callahan and Carl Willingham went to the front of the car, as close as they could get without waiting, and examined the mired wheels. It wasn't your fault, Mr. Henderson, she said, with a voice that did funny things to me. The pipe is clogged and the drive was badly undercut. The others moved on up to check on it. Maybe we could put something under the wheels to give it some traction, Poe McNeil suggested. Won't do no good, Carl Willingham grunted. Car's too heavy and in too deep. Have to get a tow truck. The brown water swirled around the bumper. Great, Dad said. How do we do that? I guess we could wait till another car comes along and send them, Poe said without much conviction. How will they turn around? Trust Dad to put his finger on it. We may have 300 cars piled up here before the night is over. Poe grinned. The tow truck drivers will love it. What about that house there? Dad asked, squinting through the rain. A flash of lightning and a roll of thunder punctuated his question. Much too convenient, more like William Castle than Alfred Hitchcock. I noticed some chimneys. Maybe there's a fireplace where we can dry out and get warm. That was Anne. Carl looked up the hill with displeasure. Nobody lived in that house for 50 years. Like as not, it's about to fall down. Guess we could check it out, Poe said doubtfully. Do you think the owner would mind a band of pilgrims taking refuge? Professor Weatherly spoke for the first time. I suppose I'm the owner. You have my permission. His voice had a tenseness in it like somebody with a pat hand. Carl's frown grew deeper. Don't know that I'd fancy spending the night in that house. Don't tell me it's haunted, Poe cried with suppressed excitement. Don't rightly know, Quarles answered with no trace of humor, though I've heard folks talk. The professor looked at Quarles with a little frown, as if he'd misread one of his cards. I'll get a flashlight, Dad said, and opened the door of the station wagon. He leaned in, trying to keep himself covered with the umbrella. Ben, hand me the flashlight. He looked at Mom. We're going to check out that house to see if it's fit to spend the night in. Mom nodded and looked through the darkness, trying to see it. I dug the flashlight out from behind the seat. May I go with you? No, you can't. If it's not fit, there's no point in you getting wet. Heck, I said. Heck yourself, then he grinned. Come on. I got another umbrella from the backseat cornucopia and scrambled out. Poe was leaning in the window of the Firebird telling the other people what was happening. Then we all traipsed up the hill to the house. With the darkness and the rain and trying to see where we were putting our feet, none of us really paid much attention to the house until we made it the old-fashioned porch around three sides. Once out of the rain, we looked about without saying anything. The house was a little weather-beaten and badly needed paint, but it wasn't what one would call dilapidated. A few pieces of gingerbread were missing from around the top of the porch, and a few boards squeaked when we stepped on, but I've seen people living in a lot worse. Dad looked at the others and opened the wide front door with a fan light over it. He shined the flashlight around, and the rest was crowded in behind him. My arm bumped Anne's. She smiled at me. It was just one of those friendly but non-committal smiles you give to strangers, but I felt my face getting warm. We were in a large entry hall, I finally noticed. A wide staircase ascended to a second floor landing at the rear. We looked at each other with no small amount of bewilderment. Everything was clean and free of dust. The carpet running down the middle of the hall and up the stairs was faded but in good condition. The lace curtains over the windows on either side of the door, though somewhat yellowed with age, were clean. A tall grandfather clock at the top of the stairs suddenly rattled and struck six times. We all stared at it, hardly breathing, until it finished. When does Vincent Price arrive? Poe muttered. What? Anne said, turning her head suddenly toward him. Nothing, he grinned. Dad looked at Quarles. Are you sure that it's been empty for 50 years? He shrugged stoically. Always thought it was. Must have been wrong. We wandered into the living room, though I imagine it was called the parlor in its day, which opened to the left off the entry hall. If this belongs to you, Professor, Anne said softly, you should know if anyone's been living here. He was genuinely confused. Mr. Willingham's right. No one has lived here for 50 years. When I was last here 35 years ago, I hired a man to look after the place. Apparently he's doing his job very well. The living room parlor was completely and neatly furnished in that blocky, ungainly style of the early 20s. Even so, it didn't actually look as if someone lived there. More like a display, the Sunday parlor kept spotlessly unused for company that never came. There's wood for the fireplace, Dad brightened. I was afraid we might have to burn the furniture. Poe wrinkled his nose. Wouldn't hurt. The professor came out of his mood. Why don't you get the others from the cars and whatever else you might need while Mr. Willingham and I get a fire going? So we re-entered the downpour and slogged back to the cars. Anne smiled at me as we went down the porch steps. I missed one with my foot and had to grab the railing. Damnation. When we returned with the suitcases, blankets, and everything else we could carry, Weatherly and Carl had a crackling fire going. That and the half-dozen kerosene lamps scattered around the room made it almost cheerful. We all trooped in, bustling around, shedding raincoats and umbrellas, and looking around tentatively. Everyone was happily excited and seemed to regard the whole thing as an adventure. This is terrific, Linda McNeil said with delight. I was expecting spiders and rats. Poe's wife was 22, blonde, pink, and pretty, and very pregnant. Poe helped her with her raincoat. I like Linda as much as I did Poe. Either that or some farmer would be using it to store hay. That was Judson Bradley Ledbetter, known professionally as Judd Bradley. He thought Ledbetter sounded a bit too hayseed. It was easy enough to tell he was Linda's brother. He was also blonde, pink, and pretty, but with a dark undercurrent missing in Linda. I thought he was a bit overdressed and had obviously swept his shoes from Carmen Miranda. Where are the ghosts? Tanny asked, ready to get down to business. They don't show up till midnight, I said with a straight face. Stop it, Ben, Mom said. You know she believes everything you tell her. You okay, hon? Poe said to his wife. You oughtn't to catch cold. You're the one who looks like you've been swimming with your clothes on. He grinned. I was expecting Fred McMurray to paddle by in a rowboat. The rains of Ranch Shapur, Linda cried gleefully. Right. Mom wasn't one to let things go untended. I have some towels in the suitcases, she said, and fished out several. She handed one to Linda. Thank you, Linda smiled. Just my hair and feet are wet. Is this your first? Mom asked. Yes. It's all sort of terrific, isn't it? Yes, it is, Mom laughed. I felt the same way when I had my two. Here, sit by the fire and take off your shoes. She and Poe pushed one of the chairs closer to the fire and fussed over Linda. Then she gave Tanny and me each a towel with instructions to dry everything that was wet. Mom was in high gear now that she had something to do. I guess that's one of the reasons she made such a good faculty wife. There are a lot of women who can't hack it. I've seen perfectly level-headed women go glassy-eyed at the thought of one more faculty tea and assistant professor's wife seriously consider sticking their heads in the oven after being cut down by a full professor's wife, delicately and with no visible wounds, of course. Mom says a faculty wife has to be one quarter hostess, one quarter scullery maid, one quarter diplomat, one quarter secret agent, and 100% saint. If everyone is getting settled, the professor said in his role as reluctant leader of the castaways, I'll get my suitcases. I also have some food. I'll go with you, Dad volunteered. We have some coffee in the car. Thank you, Weatherly replied. There's a stove in the kitchen, but I'm afraid no hot water. Claire, would you put some water on? Dad asked. We'll be right back. Of course. They left and everyone was snuggling in quite comfortably. I got dry, socks for myself and Tanny from the suitcase. Mom and Poe still hovered over Linda. Carl Willingham and Judson Bradley Ledbetter rotated themselves in front of the fire, drying off. Jun soon gave it up and went into another room to put on dry clothes, after fussing around in several matched pieces of luggage. When is it due, Mom asked, not quite having exhausted the topic of babies. 5 weeks, Linda said. We were on our way to visit Linda's parents in Wichita before she got too big to travel. Poe smiled, a proud and slightly mystified father-to-be smile. We live in Flagstaff. Oh, Poe, Linda moaned. They're going to be so worried when we don't show up. We're supposed to be there by 8. I know, hon, but there's nothing we can do about it. Would you like a blanket? Mom handed her one before she could answer. Thank you, Mrs. She laughed. I don't know your name. Claire Henderson. I guess that's the first thing we ought to do. That was my husband, Charles, who just went for coffee, my son, Ben, and my daughter, Tanny. Everyone had the slightly nervous fidgets you get when you introduce yourself to strangers, except me. I was looking at Ann Canahan, just coming into the room from an exploration foray. My name is Tanya Henderson, Tanny announced proudly, after my grandmother. That's a terrific name, Anne said as she joined us. Thank you very much, Tanny smiled at her. You're welcome, Anne beamed back at her. I'm Anne Callahan from Albuquerque. Poe McNeil. I won't mention what the Poe is short for. My wife, Linda. That's my brother in there, Linda said, inclining her head towards the closed door. Judd Ledbetter. He lives in Hollywood. Mom raised her eyebrows questioningly. Is he an actor? He's handsome enough to be. Linda's mouth quivered with a suppressed grin. He'll probably tell you who he is, she said, but he's a model. You may recognize the back of his head. The grin broke through and Poe chuckled. He's been in a lot of commercials, but the camera's always on the girl's shiny hair or her gleaming white cavity-free bicuspids. All you ever see of Judd is the back of his head. If you'd like to hear a choice account of the doubtful ancestry of TV commercial producers and directors, bring the subject up. She and Poe both smothered laughter. Why are you laughing, Mom? Asked in confusion. He seems fortunate to me. Oh, he is, Poe controlled himself. He makes money hand over fist, a lot more than I'll ever make. You see, Mrs. Henderson, Judd and Linda and I grew up together in Wichita. Judd and I were in the same grade. It's just hard for us to take him seriously. We know too much about him. Poe plucked at his sodden clothes, unsticking the fabric from his skin. If you'll excuse me, I'll follow my beautiful brother-in-law's example and put on some dry clothes. He rummaged around in his suitcase and followed Judd. I take it your husband and brother don't get on too well, Mom said. No, it isn't that, Linda said, hitching a blanket higher around her shoulder. They've seen very little of each other since high school, and Judge changed a lot since then. I think the term has gone Hollywood. It's nothing serious. Judd's airs amuse Poe, and Poe's amusement irritates Judd. Would you care to join me in the water boiling detail? Mom asked Anne, suddenly remembering. Sure, she said. They took a lamp and went in the direction opposite Judd and Poe. I wonder when they will read the will, Poe said when they came back. Huh? I asked because my mind was still on Anne. In the movies, he explained, when a bunch of people are gathered in a spooky old house like this, they generally read the will, but there's always a stipulation that they spend the night, and then the beneficiaries are murdered one by one. Poe, Linda frowned, don't talk that way. You'll scare Tanny. Nothing scares her, I said. Does too, Tanny asserted. Either that, Poe continued undaunted, or they're lured there by a mysterious host who then murders them one by one. And then there were none. And the 13th ghost, I supplied. Uh-oh, Linda laughed. Poe's found a kindred spirit. Huh? I said with another example of my brilliant repartee. Poe and Linda ask each other questions about old movies, Judd explained, with no small amount of condensation. If one can stump the other, he gets a point. It's a game we play on trips to pass the time, Poe said with a slight narrowing of his eyes. May I play? I asked. Sure, Linda laughed. I'm not much of a challenge. Be warned, young man, Poe grinned. You're proposing a master. Okay, my turn, Linda said and looked studious. Let's see. How many times was Scarlett O'Hara married? Poe turned to me with mock exasperation. You can see the kind of competition I have. You know the answer to that one? Sure, I grinned. 3. No points for Linda, he growled. She made a face at him. All right, he continued, preparing a zinger. What famous star of B-Westerns once played the romantic lead opposite Greta Garbo? He settled back with a satisfied smirk. Linda looked at him suspiciously. You're making that up. No, I'm not, he laughed. Johnny Mac Brown, Judd muttered. An expression of abject betrayal settled on Poe's face. How did you know? He groaned. Judd raised his pale eyebrows. You mean that's right? I just said the most unlikely name I could think of. I was going to say Lash LaRue, Linda said with a straight face. We were all laughing when Dad and Professor Weatherly came back. The professor had a suitcase and a picnic hamper. Dad had a cardboard box with instant coffee, styrofoam cups, sugar, powdered cream, and a bunch of other stuff. We were helping them unpack it all when Mom and Anne returned, looking smug. Water's on, Mom announced. With a little native ingenuity, feminine intuition, and a lot of luck, we figured out how to work that antique kerosene stove. Professor, Anne said with a slight frown, does your caretaker live here in the house? There's food in the kitchen. Not much, mostly canned stuff. I don't know, he said with a befuddled look. The man I hired lived in Holly with his wife. Maybe some hobo has taken squatter's rights, Judd said. Wouldn't be nobody from around here, Carl said with assurance. Folks in Holly stay away from this place. You're here, Mr. Willingham, Mom pointed out. Have you changed your mind about the place being haunted? Never said it was haunted, he stated phlegmatically. Just said folks talk. What happened then is difficult to explain. Poe and I had gone back to Linda at the fireplace. I was sitting in a chair next to Linda while Poe sat on the floor with his arms around his knees. Everyone else was at a table about 10 feet away, unpacking the professor's picnic hamper. I was thinking that he surely had brought a lot of food for some reason. I felt it coming before it hit me, but I was so startled I didn't do anything to protect myself. There was an impact, then pressure that knocked the breath out of me. If I'd been standing, I think I would have fallen. My head flopped back against the chair. It couldn't have lasted more than a second, but the residue of cold fear was overpowering. The sweet chill of fear drenched, infused with icy sugar water. My eyes closed and I shivered uncontrollably. My arms were so weak I couldn't lift them. I never knew so much fear. But not my fear. One eternal second and it was gone. The pressure and the presence gone as suddenly as it came. I could hear what everyone was saying, their tiny voices far away, and I knew what everyone else was doing, not seeing them with my eyes. In that chill second, Anne gasped and looked around quickly, seeking a source of what? Everyone stopped talking and looked at Anne, Professor Weatherly, with more interest than I could explain. Then Linda looked at me. Mrs. Henderson, she shouted, something's wrong with Ben. Everyone gathered around me except Judd and Carl. Anne was shaken. They helped her to a chair. Tanny stared at me with eyes like saucers. Mom and Dad knelt beside me. Mom put her hands on my clammy face. Darling, what's the matter? I tried to open my eyes, but my eyelids fluttered like moth wings, and I couldn't focus. Ben, Dad said, strain and worry harsh in his voice. Son, say something. Mom, I whimpered. I wasn't ashamed of whimpering. I was thankful I didn't scream. Mom put her arms around my shoulders and pulled me against her breast, holding me like I was 2 years old. Dad had his hand on the back of my head. I opened up all the way, let down all the barriers. I supped up their love and concern and compassion. I bathed in it, swam in it, drowned in it. I let the warmth of it wash over me, let it drive out the chill of that fear. What is it, Ben? Are you ill? Mom asked softly. Oh, Mom, it was so scared, I moaned against her shoulder. What was scared? Dad asked in confusion. My eyes focused on Anne over Mom's shoulder. She was staring at me, staring with stupid and surprised recognition. But she was no more surprised than I. Professor Weatherly was looking from Anne to me and back again, like a startled owl. Then I saw everyone else was staring at me too, and I got a little embarrassed. I disengaged Mom's arms and leaned back in the chair because I wasn't sure I could stand up, but I didn't take my eyes off Anne. I don't know, Dad, I said, trying to answer his question. Suddenly, I felt it was like I had my breath knocked out, and there was so much fear. That's what I felt, only not so strongly, Anne said calmly. Tanny slowly and tentatively took my hand in hers and looked at me with big, round, scared eyes. I grinned at her and winked. Her little face sort of exploded as she grinned back. Mom turned to Anne. Are you feeling better, Anne? Yes, I'm fine. Tanny suddenly perked up and piped. It must have been the ghost. A little wave of nervous laughter rippled around the room. I think she's right, Poe grinned. I've seen enough movies to know a haunted house. I've heard people talk, Carl said with a nod of his head. You keep saying that, Judd grumbled. Exactly what do folks talk about? This house and what happened here 50 years ago. I knew it, Poe cried, and clapped his hands together sharply. A house doesn't get a reputation for being haunted unless there's a story to go with it. What happened 50 years ago? A juicy murder? First time I've been in this place, Carl said a little abashed at being the focus of attention. Nobody I know's ever been inside. Seen it lots of times from the road. Used to be the main road before they built the highway. Well, what happened? Poe squirmed. Professor Weatherly was distinctly uncomfortable and wished he were somewhere else. Happened before I was born, but I've heard folks talk. Carl continued warming to his subject. The Weatherlys lived here, had a right nice farm, folks say. That was before the Depression. Man, wife, two girls and a boy. Real well-liked, I hear, though folks say there was something peculiar about the boy. One night, folks living close by saw the house all lit up kind of funny. Lights dancing all over it, and flames in one of the upstairs rooms. Thought the place was burning and rushed over to help. When they got here, there was nothing, no fire, nothing. They called, nobody answered. They went inside and looked all over, didn't find nobody. Just found that upstairs room where the fire was. They say it was the boys' room. The inside was all burned, but the fire was cold out. Nobody ever saw the Weatherlys or heard tell of them since. Hey, Poe exhaled slowly. That's even better than a juicy murder. Didn't they ever find out what happened? Dad asked. Nope, Carl shrugged. Not that I ever heard. Professor Anne turned to him. You told me when we were stopped on the highway you used to live around here. In this house? Yes, for a time. He fidgeted, then changed the subject. Do you suppose the water's boiling, Mrs. Henderson? I'm ready for a cup of coffee. Oops, Mom laughed. I forgot about the water. She looked questioningly at me and I nodded. She hurried from the room and continued to look speculatively at the professor, but decided to let it drop for the moment. You said there were people living close by, Poe said hopefully. Maybe we could walk to one of them and phone for a tow truck. And my parents, Linda added. Carl shook his head. Ain't there no more? Not many small farms anymore. Reckon there's not another house for 4 or 5 miles? Forget I mentioned it, Poe grunted, and settled back. Mom returned with a steaming kettle and put it beside the coffee stuff. We made coffee and sandwiches from the copious picnic hamper and went back to the fireplace. All of us except Carl. He was standing at the window, looking through the rain towards the car. He was more worried and nervous than the rest of us. Then he turned from the window and joined us. He was frowning and wearing his cigar to a frazzle. It's real funny, he said. I've been kind of keeping an eye on the road. Hasn't been another car long since we got here. Maybe the water went down, Judd said in a bored voice. Not likely, Dad frowned also. It's still raining. The answer's very simple, Poe pronounced in mock gloom. The ghosts lured us here for some diabolical reasons of their own and are now keeping everyone else away. Professor Weatherly gave him a startled owl look. Well, well, the professor seemed to concur with that opinion. Linda laughed and shivered. Poe, stop. You're scaring me now. Not at all, young man, Weatherly rushed in to repair the breach. Obviously, they've discovered the detour is also flooded and are turning the cars around. Poe grimaced and laughed. Spoil sport. Anne picked up the kettle and looked at me. I'll put on some more water, she said and left the room. I followed her, kicking myself for not getting her alone sooner. The door to the kitchen was open. I leaned against the door jamb and watched her fill the kettle from the hand pump. She had short, dark hair, actually not much longer than mine. She was tall, with long, very good legs. With high heels, she would be taller than I, but she was wearing sneakers. I was 5'10", but I hoped to make it to 6 feet in a couple of years. I know I didn't make a sound, and she had her back to me. Hello, Ben Henderson, she said without turning around. The kitchen was dark and gloomy, even though one of the kerosene lamps was burning. I had her alone, and I didn't know what to say, so I pretended interest in the lamp. It's a wonder people didn't go blind, with no more light than these things make, I gritted my teeth. They probably did, she said, and lit the burner under the kettle. Then she turned and looked at me. She had a faint, slightly impudent smile on her lips. I felt as if I were standing there stark naked. It came so suddenly and unexpectedly. I blushed like a virgin. Then I blushed because I was blushing. The sensation was so erotic. I had to do some fancy mental footwork to keep from really embarrassing myself. She laughed, but there was only fondness in it. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to embarrass you. I only wanted to see if you could pick it up. Loud and clear, I said, finding the tingle in the pit of my stomach. You're a very good-looking young man, she said matter-of-factly. You should be used to it. It was a little different this time. You knew I was picking it up. She leaned back against the kitchen cabinets. Her voice was wistful. Don't you sometimes wish you were like everyone else? Do you get sick to death of always knowing? Yeah, sometimes. You're very lucky, you know. Your family loves you very much. You don't have a family, do you? No, my parents were both killed when I was little. I was adopted by my aunt. Did you see that? No, not really. I felt sadness and a sense of loss when you mentioned my family. It had to have been something like that. My aunt and uncle are very good to me, but unlike you, there's no warm, comfortable glow into which I can retreat when things get a bit overwhelming. So, I did something I'd been wanting to do since I found out Anne was like me. She looked at me with pleased surprise. Thank you, Ben, she said softly, like white velvet flowing over burnished gold. Think nothing of it. Warm, comfortable glows supplied on demand. You're an idiot, she chuckled. It was real, you know. Yes, of course, I know, she said simply. Then she laughed. And watch it. I've picked up that one before. Sorry, I grinned, involuntary reflex. Besides, you started it. You're not a child to me, Ben. I had again that feel of white velvet. I know. It takes a little getting used to, I guess. I thought I was all alone. Seeing yourself as others see you is true with a vengeance in our case. I guess The worst part of it is so many things are boring. Like card games and school. Did you skip a grade?
Yeah.
Me too. I'm in my last year of college. One more year of high school. What will you do when you finish? She shrugged. I'll probably do post-grad work and get my doctorate in psychology. A smile. That's one field we're very good in. I looked at her and she looked at me. It was good, so good, but we had a problem. What do you think Professor Weatherly is up to? She frowned. I don't know. I have a feeling all this has been contrived somehow. I felt the same thing, but I didn't say so. She knew. He's my psychology professor at the University of New Mexico. When I stopped at that roadblock and he pulled in behind me, I was surprised, to say the least. He said he was on his way to Holly, that he had lived near there as a child, that he owned some property, and had come to settle some affairs. She looked around the room. This seems to be the property, and we seem to be enmeshed in his affairs. How did you happen to be here? She shrugged. No reason in particular. After classes yesterday, I just decided to take a drive over the weekend. I don't know why. It seemed a good idea at the time, though I'm not so sure now. She looked at me and smiled. I felt the hum of violin strings. No, it was a good idea. She lowered her eyes. The water's boiling. We'd better go back. She turned toward the stove with her back to me. Ben, what were you thinking a moment ago? I didn't mind. I know, I said, and took the kettle. She turned off the burner and looked at me. It never even occurred to me to blush. On the way back to the parlor, we found Tanny sitting on the bottom step of the stairway with one of the kerosene lamps beside her. She had her elbows on her knees and her chin in her hands. She had that perplexed expression she would get when she ran up against something too complex for her to understand. She was obviously waiting for me to help her out. Tanny, what are you doing wandering around? I asked. I wanted to see the burned room, she mumbled, with her mind still on something else. Did you find it? Anne asked. Yes, thank you, she said politely, then looked up at me with a little frown. Ben, what do ghosts look like? I don't know, I said, and laughed because she was so serious. I've never seen one. She looked at her toes and absently scratched her leg. I always thought there were sheets or that you could see right through them. Now I think they look just like people. What did you see? I asked seriously because I knew she'd seen something. There was a lady in the burn room. She was about 200 years old and wore funny clothes. She looked up at me again with a puzzled little squint. Tanny related all this to me very matter-of-factly because she knew I never disbelieved her when she was telling me the truth. I put the kettle on the floor and sat beside her on the step. What did the lady do? Nothing. She wouldn't talk to me. I took her hand and stood up. Come on back to the fire. Anne and I will go see. Mom, Dad, Poe, and Linda were playing bridge. Carl was looking out the window again, and Judd was reading Rexer's Read, Conversations in the Raw. Weatherly sat on the couch, looking depressed. Mom, I said, Tanny was exploring. What? I thought she was with you. Tanny, you know better than to wander off without telling us. Heck, Mom, Tanny sighed, expressing the triviality of her offense. I was just talking to the ghost. The reaction from Weatherly was so strong that I turned and looked at him. He was a severely startled man. Mom smiled. Sure you were. I'll be back in a minute, I said, still watching the professor. Anne and I are going to look around. Okay, be careful. Sure. I retrieved the lamp from where Tanny left it on the stairs. Tanny was telling the truth, I said. She saw somebody. Yes, I know, Anne smiled. I smiled back at her because it was the easiest and most pleasant thing in the world to do. I keep forgetting, Professor Weatherly is definitely keeping secrets from us. I know that, too. He wasn't telling the exact truth when he said he lived here as a child. Didn't he? That part's true, he did. But he was evading the issue somewhere. Didn't you pick it up? I wasn't thinking about it. I seldom read people without a good reason. It's usually too discomforting and embarrassing. I just sort of close them out like a background noise you get used to and don't hear unless you listen for it. Or unless it's very strong, like when Tanny mentioned the ghost. I picked up an extreme dose of surprise and confusion. I don't think the professor was expecting to find anyone here. We checked out several upstairs rooms, all bedrooms, before we found the burned room. One door, which should have led to the tower, if my memory of its position was correct, was locked. I raised my eyebrows questioningly at Anne. She shrugged. The burn room had been a bedroom as well. It looked as if no one had touched it since the fire 50 years ago. The furniture and walls were charred in places, but only scorched in others, as if the fire had raged fiercely for a few minutes and then been instantly doused. But there was no old lady with funny clothes. When we got back downstairs, Tanny was facing the others defiantly and near tears. She turned and ran to me. "Ben, would you please tell these people what I saw?" she said with a quiver in her voice. I knelt and took her in my arms. She put her arms around my neck and valiantly kept from crying. "I'm sorry, honey," I said softly. "When we got there, she was gone." "Do you think I'm imagining things too?" The quiver had grown more pronounced at the thought that I too might be against her. "Of course not," I said firmly. "She really did see someone," I said to the others. I stood up, but Tammy kept a grip on my hand. "How are you so sure?" Judson Bradley Ledbetter asked with a supercilious sneer. "Has the ghost made an appearance?" Poe asked with genuine interest. "You'll have to ask Professor Weatherly about that," I said. The professor frowned at me, as if one of his own troops had turned on him. He fidgeted a bit and then sighed. "I can assure you there are no ghosts in this house," he snapped irritably. "However, you are due an explanation, as I see some of you are letting your imagination run away with you. Before I explain anything, and I still can't tell you everything, I want to show you something." He went to the table where the bridge game had been abandoned. "Why can't you tell us everything?" Dad asked, becoming a little bit irritable himself. "You wouldn't believe me, Mr. Henderson," he sighed impatiently. "And there's no point in alarming you unnecessarily." Poe grunted. "It's statements like that that alarm me unnecessarily." "Mr. McNeil," Weatherly snapped, "there are no ghosts. You are in no danger. Please stop this wild speculation." Poe hunkered his head protectively between his shoulders and grinned at me. Anne and I cocked an eyebrow at each other. Weatherly was difficult. He was telling the truth, but I had a feeling it was only technically the truth. "Now everyone," he continued and sat at the table, "gather around. Ben, you and two others sit down." I sat opposite him, eager to cooperate and find out what was going on. Anne stood behind me. Mom and Dad sat in the other chairs. Everyone else gathered around except Carl, who watched from the other side of the room. I had the impression he was staying close to the door, on the verge of bolting. Weatherly gathered up the cards and handed them to Mom. "Now, Mrs. Henderson, please shuffle the cards carefully and deal out four hands." Mom gave him a quizzical frown, but did as he asked. Weatherly picked up his cards and fanned them. The rest of us did the same. I had 13 clubs neatly arranged in order, with a deuce on the left and the ace on the right. "Now, Ben," Weatherly said, "tell us who has the winning hand," and we were playing bridge. "Dad," I said. He nodded with satisfaction. "Correct," he said crisply, and laid his cards face up on the table. He had 13 hearts, Mom had 13 diamonds, and Dad had 13 spades. "Explain how you knew." "I can't explain," I said with a frown. "It's like explaining sight or sound or smell to someone lacking them. Dad knew he had the winning hand, and I sensed him knowing it." "Did you know exactly which card he had?" Weatherly asked intensely. "No, but it wasn't hard to figure out when I saw mine." "Read everyone in the room, Ben," he said, like a wire stretched to the breaking point. He never took his eyes off mine. "Your parents. Concern, love. Tanny. She's still mad. Poe. Interest, wonder. Linda. Love, incomprehension. Mr. Ledbetter. Disbelief, annoyance. Mr. Willingham. Nervousness, stoicism. Me. Determination." I narrowed my eyes a little, and he knew I read more than that, but I didn't say anything else. "Anne?" I hesitated. How could I put Anne into words? I couldn't, and so I just grinned like a sap. Anne put her arm around my shoulder. "Ben," Mom said in a tight little voice. I hadn't really wanted my parents to find out like this. though my father had known subconsciously for quite some time. He had never said anything. He hadn't wanted to upset Mom and didn't really want to believe it himself. Now they were both confused and frightened. I started to say something to try to ease their worries, but Anne beat me to it. "Don't you see, Claire," she said quietly, "you and Charles think of Ben as an adolescent, so he acts the part to please you. It's difficult for us to be ourselves and not just a reflection of others. I went through the same thing. No one likes an uppity kid." She ran her fingernails through the hair on the back of my neck. All I could do was grin and turn red. She hit me lightly on the back of the head. "Ben?" Mom said again. "I know, Mom." "So there you are," Weatherly said, getting us back on the path of his purpose, whatever that was. "Anne could have told me the same things. They are both telepathic and empathic, though Ben is the more sensitive." "Telepathic?" Judd snorted and poured himself another cup of coffee. "Don't worry, Judd," Anne assured him. "We can't read your thoughts, only your emotions, your state of mind, and the like." But I also knew who had the winning hand. Weatherly barreled ahead. I knew where every card lay because I controlled the deal. If I hadn't, I wouldn't have known any more than the man in the moon. "I figured that," I said. "How did you control the deal?" Dad had accepted everything completely. "That too is difficult to explain," Weatherly sighed. "Ben and Anne are telepathic and empathic. My own ability is telekinesis, though I believe these days they're calling it psychokinesis." There was a momentary silence. "What's that?" Linda asked, wide-eyed. Poe had his arm around her and she leaned against him. Poe was quiet, absorbing everything. "The ability to mentally control physical objects," Weatherly explained tersely. "You mean mind over matter?" Linda breathed. "Yes," he sighed. "I believe that is the popular term." Judd was pacing a short path on the faded carpet. "Let's see you make that shoe move," he snorted, and pointed to Poe's still damp sneaker on the hearth. Weatherly leaned back in the chair and tiredly raised his hand over his face, his broadcast resignation to the constant interruption. He nodded and the shoe rose into the air. Mom and Linda gasped. Tanny was watching bug-eyed. Carl Willingham eased a little closer to the door. The shoe made a circle of the room and plopped back on the hearth. "There's more to it than moving shoes about, Mr. Ledbetter," Weatherly explained impatiently. "Matter can also be controlled on a molecular level. Mrs. Henderson, lift the top card, please, and look at it." She gave him a curious look and turned the card. It was the Three of Hearts. "Turn it face down again." Mom did so. "Now look at it." Mom exposed it once more. The hearts had been replaced by little yellow daisies. "It is now the Three of Daisies," Weatherly said without looking at it. "I could continue to perform carnival tricks until morning, but there are more important matters. There's something absolutely vital which I must do. I could not do it alone, not without the aid of a telepath. I've been searching for 35 years. I just about given up hope, and then I found Anne. My dear, I must apologize for the way I maneuvered you here." "Maneuvered?" "Yes. I'm afraid it's turned into something of an imbroglio. However, I instigated your weekend ride by thinking it at you for the past 2 weeks. Naturally, you thought it was your own idea. I created the rainstorm, the roadblock, and the flooded detour. Of course, I never intended the rest of you people to fall into my little charade." "Yes," he sighed, "I seems to have botched it rather badly." He brightened, "but actually it has turned out rather well. If things had gone according to plan, I wouldn't have found Ben." "I don't believe any of this." Judd flopped onto the couch and stretched his long, fashionably sheathed legs in front of him. He looked away with a sour expression. "Really, young man," Weatherly said in exasperation, "creating a rainstorm, a couple of wooden barricades, an animated yellow slicker, and a little water over the road differs from controlling a deck of cards only in degree. It's exactly the same principle." "If you can do all that," Dad said suspiciously, "you could have gotten my car out of the ditch." "Most assuredly, Mr. Henderson, but you see, and I must apologize, it was I who put your car in the ditch." "Why?" Mom asked. "Oh dear, isn't it obvious?" Weatherly whined. "In order to keep Anne here, I was forced to keep all of you." Why did you go through all these elaborate machinations, Professor? Anne asked seriously. Why didn't you just ask me to help you? I couldn't take the chance. If you had refused, it was imperative that you come. I'm an old man, Anne. This is my last chance. If I'm unsuccessful again, his shoulders slumped, then God help us. Stunned silence spread over the room like a blanket and lay there. Then Anne spoke softly. What is it you want me to do? Please be patient with me, my dear. He sighed and ran his hand over his face again. His eyes were bleary from nervous strain and his skin had developed a putty-colored pallor. I still didn't know what he was up to, but he didn't appear to be in a condition to subdue an irritated kitten. There are preparations that must be made before I can explain fully. Imagine, he brightened, after 35 years, I find 2 telepaths. Just a minute, Dad said with a hardness in his voice I'd seldom heard before. If Anne wants to help you with whatever you're doing, that's her affair, but Ben is not to be involved. Weatherly's chin set firmly. He was about to argue, but Judd jumped up to pace again. He rubbed his hands on the fabric, molding his hips, and said with nervous volume, I think you're all nuts. You're sitting around talking about telepathy, telekinesis, and creative rainstorms, and as if we were talking about the weather. All I've seen is a man whose sanity I am beginning to doubt do card tricks. He stopped and fixed Weatherly with a pale blue glare. Judd, please, Linda whispered in embarrassment. Don't forget the shoe, Poe said brightly. Judd transferred the glare to his brother-in-law. Poe grinned and raised his eyebrows. Judd turned back to the professor. If you can do all this hocus-pocus, will you kindly turn off the rain, get Mr. Henderson's car out of the ditch, and let us get out of this freak show? His voice rose a little in volume with each word. Weatherly matched him decibel for decibel. I am not a magician, Mr. Ledbetter. I can't snap my fingers and turn off the rain. It took 2 days of careful manipulation to create it in the first place. Besides, his voice lowered to conciliatory tones, there is no point in your leaving. You have to spend the night somewhere. Might as well be here. There are very comfortable bedrooms upstairs. If any of you wish to retire, I'll show you the way. Judd wasn't easily giving up. You mean we stay whether we like it or not? My parents are expecting us tonight, and I want to leave. I'm sorry, Mr. Ledbetter. Take my word, it is impossible. Anne and I looked at each other. We had both caught the same thing. He was telling the truth as he saw it. It was impossible for us to leave, and not because of the weather, but neither of us could get the real reason. Take it easy, Judd, Poe said sensibly. We're so late now, a few more hours won't matter. Okay, okay, Judd shrugged elaborately and sat at the now empty table. He picked up the cards and shuffled them. You go right ahead with your spook hunt. I shall sit right here and play solitaire all night. I don't care if 20 ghosts come traipsing through here rattling chains and moaning their heads off. I shall be totally oblivious to them. He dealt out a hand of solitaire and pointedly ignored us. Edwin looked at him with some amusement for a moment. His shouting match with the professor had done quite a bit to break the tension in the air. Then Mom sort of shook her head and said, I know one young lady who needs to go to bed. Do I have to? Tanny groaned. Things are much too interesting to go to bed. Yes, you do, Mom laughed. She took one of the suitcases and led Tanny out. Tanny said goodnight to everyone, kissed Dad and me, then gave me a defeated look. I winked at her. They left and Tanny came back almost immediately. Mom forgot the flashlight, she said. Dad was about to hand it to her when we heard Mom gasp and drop the suitcase. We all scrambled into the hall. Mom was standing at the foot of the stairs, with her hand over her mouth, looking up. The suitcase lay on its side at her feet. I saw someone standing at the top of the stairs, she said with a controlled voice. Dad pointed the flashlight at the top of the stairs and turned it on. There was no one there. The grandfather clock suddenly rattled and struck 8 o'clock. A startled squeak escaped from Linda. Dad moved the beam lower and caught a man descending towards us. He was young, about the same age as Poe and Judd, dressed in rough clothes with no expression on his dark Slavic face. That's the way he appeared to my eyes. When I looked at him without using my eyes, he was a featureless shimmer. Dad kept a flashlight on him. "It's Lester Gant," Carl Willingham said from behind us as if he were identifying a rabid dog. The man reached the bottom of the stairs and stood there looking at us, still with no expression. The clock stopped striking. For some reason, we all took a half step backward. "You know him?" Weatherly asked, slipping back into the befuddlement he had only recently escaped. I had the impression he couldn't take very much more interruptions and complications. "Is this the caretaker?" Dad asked. "What?" Weatherly turned to him with a slight jerk of the head. "Of course not. That was 35 years ago. Wait, yes, the man's name was Gant. What was it, Horace, Homer?" "Lester's father was Harold Gant," Carl supplied. "Is that it?" "Possibly," the professor nodded and turned back to the dark young man. "Mr. Gant, is your father the caretaker I hired?" "Old man Gant's been dead over 10 years, Carl said. "Leastways, him and his wife disappeared." "Ah," Poe widened his eyes, "more mysteries." "You don't keep very close track of your caretakers, Professor," Dad grunted. "What?" His head did another revolution. "Oh, the bank in Holly handles all that. I suppose they gave the job to the boy when the father disappeared. Can't he talk, Mr. Willingham?" "He can talk. Heard him myself," Carl stated. And he did. 4 words. I never heard him say anything else. "Missus will be down," he said in a flat, colorless tones. "Who else is here?" Judd groaned. Weatherly sighed. "I imagine he means my mother, Mr. Ledbetter." "Your mother?" Mom squeaked. "Why didn't you tell us your mother was living here?" "I wasn't sure that she was," Weatherly sounded on his last legs. "I didn't expect she would still be alive." Gant turned without another word and vanished into the darkness at the top of the stairs. Weatherly looked as if he had been kicked in the stomach. He had had one complication too many. After a moment, Dad picked up Mom's suitcase and escorted her upstairs. "You want to go to bed, hun?" Poe asked his wife. "You must be exhausted." "If it's all the same to you," Linda laughed nervously, "I'll wait until you go. I couldn't sleep up there by myself." Poe grinned and put his arm around her. They all drifted back to the parlor, but I gave Anne a signal and went out to the front porch. The rain had stopped. I could see stars in the west and a smudge of light where the moon hid behind clouds. Frogs were screaming in damp ecstasy, and a few bold crickets had emerged from the dry hidey holes. The air had the fresh, clean smell it gets right after rain, pointing up the slight mustiness of the house. I took a deep breath and leaned against the railing, looking at the cars in the road at the bottom of the hill. "Did you see it?" I asked when I felt Anne behind me. "Yes. I ran across it a few times before. Apparently some people have natural shields." She leaned on the railing beside me. I turned when I heard the door open. But I knew who it was. Carl Willingham nodded to us and went down the porch steps. "Where are you going, Mr. Willingham?" Anne asked politely. He stopped and turned, looking up at us. "Leaving, ma'am. Rain stopped, and I'd rather walk 4 miles than stay in the same house with Lester Gant. I can take magicians and mind readers," he dipped his head. "No offense, and even flying shoes, but he's too much. I'd advise the rest of you do the same." "What's the matter with him?" I asked, because he was genuinely frightened. "Folks say he killed his parents. Never found him, no proof he did it, but folks know just the same." He nodded again and started down the hill. We watched him for a moment. "Folks around here sure say a lot," I observed wryly, and we went back in the house. Weatherly was sitting on the couch deep in gloomy thought. I had the impression of swirling muddy water. Poe, Linda, Judd, and Dad were starting another card game. "Mr. Willingham just left," I said, certainly not expecting the reaction I got. Weatherly jumped up and stared at me. "Left? What do you mean?" "He said he was gonna walk to town," I said, completely mystified. Weatherly was severely agitated. He moved around as if he couldn't decide which direction was the right one. "He can't leave," he wailed. "He'll be killed. Stop him. Bring him back by force if you have to. Hurry, hurry." Weatherly's anxiety was so strong and sharp that I ran from the room and out the front door. They all followed me, confused and frightened. Carl was almost to the bottom of the hill. I yelled at him. Dad and Poe were right behind me, not knowing what was going on. The others stayed on the porch. Carl turned and looked at us curiously. His eyebrows rose in bewilderment at the sight of us bounding down the hill, floundering in the slippery mud, yelling like madmen. Carl, the only one looking toward the house, was the first to see it. His eyes got big. He took a step backward. Then I felt it, like static electricity in my head. I skidded to a halt on the muddy ground and fell to my knees with a grunt. I looked back at the house. Weatherly was waving his arms and yelling. The crickets stopped singing. The house was surrounded by a glow, an iridescent nimbus, like a soap bubble growing larger and larger. Dad and Poe had stopped looking at the house. Weatherly was screaming, waving us back. My head was singing with a sweet chill of fear, but not my fear. The air crackled with energy. I could feel the hair on my arm standing up. Sparks danced across the hill, flowing down it like a fairy river. I turned to look at Carl. He stared at the house, backing slowly away. The static electricity in the air made his clothes cling to his skin. Then he whirled and ran. The energy pressure was growing unbearable. Then there was light, an eye-burning flash, a fierce discharge. All the energy floating free in the air gathered at one point. It circled around like a whirlwind of fireflies, swept by me, contracted, converged at one point, on Carl. He screamed. Then he was covered with fire. He screamed and ran and burned. He beat at his clothes with his hands, beat at flames with flames. His glowing feet kicked through the damp grass and left little curls of steam that sizzled and disappeared. Carl stopped his useless flailing and just ran, his arms stretched before him seeking. Then he stumbled, staggered a few steps, and fell, still screaming. He kept moving, trying to call. The screaming stopped, then the movement. Carl was nothing but a shapeless lump burning, sending a shaft of black smoke into the night air. The energy and the pressure was gone. The crickets started up again. I'd thrown up my tattered barriers, trying to shut him out, trying to block his agonies from my mind. Then I think I felt the muddy ground hit me in the face. I was moving, floating in warmth. Dad was carrying me as he had when I was 3 and had fallen asleep. I tightened my grip around his neck. Then he was prying me loose, putting me on the couch. They were all crowded around, looking at me except Judd. He was staring out the window, pale and shaken. Tanny in her pajamas was round-eyed with wonder. Anne put her hand on my forehead and pushed the hair out of my eyes. Dad was standing a few feet away, watching me. I had never known him to be so angry. "Professor Weatherly," he said in a low voice, "you told me there was no danger. I want you to explain exactly what's going on. No evasions, no promises. We'd like to make a few decisions for ourselves." "I'm sorry, Mr. Henderson," he said with honest regret. "It's too late for independent decisions. There's only one course open to us." "Did you hear what I said? I want an explanation." "Of course, Mr. Henderson." He fluttered like a moth. "Give everyone a chance to calm down and I'll tell you all I know." "Judd, come away from the window," Linda said. Her voice was so hoarse and trembled a little. Judd turned without comment and sat in a chair. "So the spirits are malignant after all, Professor," Poe said quietly. "Be patient a few minutes, please. Let's get Ben back on his feet." He looked down at me with real concern on his face. "Are you feeling better?" "Yes, I think so." I took Anne's hand in mine and squeezed it. Tanny looked at me with her little face pinched and pale. I grinned and winked at her. "I absolutely refuse to give you a hug, Benjamin Henderson," she stated uncategorically. "You had me scared to death. I thought I was going to be a widow." Everyone laughed. More than it deserved, to be sure, but it broke the tension. Even Judd managed an anemic grin. Tanny sniffed. I sat up and held my arms out to her. She threw herself at me and sobbed on my chest. "I'm sorry, honey," I said. "Oh, Tanny," Mom groaned, thankfully finding something practical on which to focus her attention. "Ben is covered with mud. You're getting it all over you." She extracted Tanny bodily. "Ben, go change your clothes and wash your face." So I went to the suitcase and got clean blue jeans and a clean shirt. I was a bit wobbly, but I tried not to show it. You can take just so much fussing. I went in a corner behind a chair and changed while they talked. Are you ready, Professor? Dad asked, nearing the end of his patience. Yes, Mr. Henderson. Everyone get comfortable. I want to explain as well as I can what happened. Ben, are you feeling it?
Yes.
Describe it to me. There's really nothing to describe. It's just there. It's aware of us. And it's just there.
That's right, Anne agreed.
There's no hostility, no anger?
Weatherly asked, as if he expected there would be.
Not now, I answered. It's frightened. I think it's always frightened.
There was anger. No, not anger, panic, when Mr. Willingham tried to leave. I finished changing clothes and joined the group. I was so busy concentrating on Weatherly, I didn't sense her presence. Neither did Anne. No one knew she was in the room until she spoke in her brassy bellow.
Philip, she brayed. What are these people doing in my house?
Everyone turned quickly. I felt Weatherly's resolve become as fragile as cobwebs. She stood in the doorway, surveying us. She wore a long black dress that reached the floor. She had a high collar that pushed her flesh into wrinkles around her sharp chin. The long-sleeved dress was unadorned for a large cameo at her throat. Her hands rested on a silver-headed stick, and her pewter-colored hair was piled on top of her head. Her skin was almost white and had a peculiar sheen, like a waxworks figure come to life. Lester Gant lurked behind her ramrod straight figure, as inscrutable as ever.
I'm waiting for an answer, Philip.
It's good to see you again, Mother, he sounded like a little boy who had been caught doing something naughty in the bathroom.
You're a fool, Philip, she stated in her clarion voice. You've always been a fool.
Yes, Mother, very good to see you again, he sighed.
She speared him with a look and sat regally in a chair near us. She moved as if her spine were of one piece.
Gant remained in the doorway.
You've come to try again, have you?
It was a statement rather than a question. The rest of us sat there with our mouths open.
Yes, he said. I was about to explain to these people.
It will kill you as it did the man just now.
I knew you were fool enough to keep trying, but I didn't know you were so obsessed as to endanger others.
They are not here by design, Mother.
How long has it been since your last futility, Philip?
35 years.
So long, she said a little wistfully.
Professor, Dad said through clenched teeth, we're waiting.
What?
He started, as if he'd forgotten the rest of us.
Yes, excuse me, Mother.
He turned away from her.
You heard how it began from Mr. Willingham. I was 10 years old. It was in my room that fire was seen. I had for some time been aware of my powers, but I thought everyone had them. Almost disastrously finding out that wasn't the case, that I was unique, I kept them secret in practice. However, as you heard Mr. Willingham say, I didn't do it in time to avoid getting a reputation in the area for being peculiar. My powers developed with practice, but I was so immature.
You are a fool.
Yes, Mother.
It happened the night Mr. Willingham told you about.
Unfortunately, I thought I knew all there was to know. You see, I had just read Wells' The Time Machine. I'm afraid attempted to travel in time.
He looked at us with an ironic frown.
Why? Dad asked, a bit dumbfounded.
Weatherly shrugged. I was 10 years old, and it seemed like an excellent idea.
What happened? Poe asked in rapt fascination.
My powers were quite strong, he continued, but my control wasn't. I didn't know at the time exactly what I had done, but I believe now that in some way I warped space, and something came through. It was ferocious. All fire and energy, it attacked me the same way it did Mr. Willingham. I tried to fight it, but was successful only in saving myself. I ran out of the house and didn't return for 15 years.
He ran away and left his family to be destroyed.
There was nothing I could do, Mother.
Why did nothing happen to you, Mrs. Weatherly? Dad asked.
Her head swiveled towards him.
I do not know why I was not destroyed. But I was not. It kept me like a souvenir. Like an insect in amber, I often wish I had been destroyed.
Thad inclined its head towards Lester Gant, still standing in the doorway regarding us impassively. What about him?
Mr. Gant is in no danger, she said, with a slightly upward twist of the corners of her thin mouth. Mr. Gant comes and goes as he pleases. It knows he will return. Mr. Gant is a worshipper.
I had the impression this was only a casual volley in an old war.
Gant looked at her without expression.
We were awakened by the commotion in Philip's room, Mrs. Weatherly picked up the story. My husband and daughters reached it first. I saw them destroyed. I hid in the attic. When the neighbors searched the house, they didn't find me, and the thing didn't bother them. By the time I had recovered from my fright, it was too late. I was unable to leave. I returned 15 years later. I was much stronger and completely in control.
You should have seen the foolish expression on his face when he found me, his mother said with a slight pucker of her thin lips.
You were here 15 years, Mom said in confusion. How did you live?
Insects and amber require nothing, she answered flatly. I do not eat. I do not sleep. I am not sure that I am even alive.
The thing I brought here has no physical existence as we know it, the professor explained. I think it sustains my mother with its own life energy.
Is it the same for him? Poe asked and indicated Lester Gant.
I looked at Gant, still standing mobile in the doorway. His eyes were slightly narrowed and focused on Anne. I didn't think much about it at the time.
Mr. Gant is here for other purposes, Mrs. Weatherly said, with that tightening of her mouth that seemed to denote amusement.
Mr. Gant is here voluntarily. Mr. Gant has secret appetites.
Gant gave her a malevolent look and turned on his heel. She watched him leave, her porcelain eyes twinkling. She turned back to us. Mr. Gant is blasphemed.
What did you do when you came back? Dad asked Weatherly, getting back on the subject.
I'll tell you what the fool did, his mother brayed, as Weatherly opened his mouth. He tried to destroy it, but it had grown stronger also, and he ran again. Then, rather than letting the house fall down as it deserves, he hired Mr. Gant's father to keep it in repair.
I did it for you, Mother. I couldn't. She stopped him with a snort.
What happened to Mr. Gant's parents? Anne asked.
Mr. Gant and I talk of many things, but that is not one of them. They moved into the house when he was a baby. It didn't matter to me. I never left my room. When Mr. Gant was about the boy's age, she pointed a bony finger at me, the parents weren't here anymore.
What are you planning to do now, Professor? Anne asked.
My mistake was in trying to destroy it, he frowned. I know now it probably can't be destroyed. But it must be stopped before it moves out of this house. I don't know why it's still here. I must communicate with it, find out what it wants. That's why I brought you, Anne, to communicate with it. You can't imagine the elation I felt when I found you. 35 years, his voice faded.
How did you spot me anyway, she asked.
Test, he raised his forefinger. That's why I became a professor of psychology, so I could test students. Test of all kinds. To thousands of students. Most of them had been somewhat altered to my purpose, rather than the original authors, of course.
What will communication accomplish, I asked, other than to satisfy your curiosity?
Isn't that enough? His eyes widened. But I expect to learn much more, much more.
If it can't be destroyed, I ask, what do you plan to do?
I must warp space and send it back where it came from, he said.
His mother looked at him speculatively.
Perhaps you are no longer such a fool. Then she shook her head.
No, you could have done it without involving the girl. You are still a fool.
She stood and walked imperially towards the door. She paused and turned, both her hands resting on the silver-headed stick.
Do not let Mr. Gant know what you are doing.
Then she went out the door and up the stairs like a wraith to disappear in the darkness.
Mom, Tanny said droopily, could I go back to bed, please? I'm sleepy.
Mom put her hand on Tammy's head. Maybe you'd better sleep down here, dear.
Why? Isn't she frightened of anything? Judd groaned.
Tanny looked at him, surprised at his ignorance.
My brother is here.
Judd grimaced and sighed. I wish I had your confidence, kid. I really do.
I guess we're safe in bed as we are here, Poe said sensibly. I'm ready myself.
I started for the door and Anne met me halfway there. I took her hand. We went back to the porch while the others bustled around preparing for bed. The sky had almost completely cleared. The night was bright, out over the Kansas pasture land. I couldn't see Carl's body, if there was anything left to see. We sat on the railing. "Ben," she said softly, "do you think we ought to be doing this? Do you know what happened to you when it killed Mr. Willingham?" "I've been working on that," I said, and turned to face her. "Read me." She concentrated for a moment, then looked at me in surprise. "You're completely shielded. I wouldn't even know you were there if I couldn't see you." "When Mr. Willingham was killed," the memory made my skin crawl, "I got the full blast. I've always had a shield of sorts. I don't pick up anything unless it's especially strong or I want to. Background babble doesn't get through at all. That's why I didn't spot you." She nodded. "I wonder how many others there are, how many we've passed in the street and didn't recognize." "I've been trying to strengthen my shield," he continued. "It was relatively easy. It has never occurred to me to try. Here, concentrate on me. I'll let it down slowly. See how it works." I showed her how it worked and she tried it. We practiced it for a while until she was as good at it as I was. She was quiet then, looking at me. She stood up and stepped in front of me, facing me. She put her hands on either side of my neck. Tanya has nothing on me when it comes to looking wide-eyed. "Ben," she said solemnly, "I know what you're feeling about what you can do. You've never explored it before, never really tried to extend the limits of your ability. I know you're strong, stronger than I, but be careful. Don't get in over your head with this thing. Don't get overconfident. Just be careful." I nodded, understanding. We looked at each other, not reading, just being physical. Then I slid my hands up her arms and interlaced my fingers behind her neck. I pulled her head down to mine slowly. She didn't resist. I kissed her very lightly on the lips, still not reading, enjoying the purely physical sensation. She pulled her head back and smiled at me. I stood up and let my arms slip lower, down her back. I felt hers do the same thing. I kissed her again harder. She kissed back. We were sitting on the steps, not doing anything, not talking, just being together, when I felt it. It was like a hobnob boot in the groin. Fear and pain, but mostly rage and anger. Anne got it too. She jerked and grunted and looked at me with pain. We jumped up and ran inside. I knew it was. I did a quick survey of the house. Only one missing. I stuck my head in the parlor, where the professor sat meditatively before the dying fire. "Where's Judd?" He jumped at the sound of my voice and looked at me blankly. I repeated the question more insistently. "He's sharing a room with you," he said, bewildered. "The second one on the top right at the top of the stairs. What's the matter?" He rose and moved toward us. "He's dead," I said over my shoulders. Anne and I ran up the stairs. We found him in the bathroom, on the floor, face down. He was wearing only gold jockey shorts. Blood was still seeping along the crevices between the white floor tiles. His blonde fairness was now pallor. Judson Bradley Ledbetter wasn't beautiful anymore. His shaving kit was scattered about as if he had hit it in his hands when attacked. I knelt beside him and turned him over. I shouldn't have. His chest and abdomen had been thoroughly worked over with a large bladed knife. Anne gasped, and Weatherly let the air hiss out between his teeth. "Who could have done it?" he whispered. "Gant." "Why?" "We don't know. Perhaps your mother does. She's in the hall." She was standing there watching us, looking exactly as she had earlier. Poe opened the door across from us and stepped sleepily into the hall, wearing pajama bottoms. "What's the commotion?" he asked, rubbing his face. Anne went to him and talked quietly. He looked frightened and hurried into the room we had come out of. "Mrs. Weatherly," I said, "Judd Ledbetter has been killed." She turned her porcelain eyes on me but said nothing. "We've read everyone in the house except Gant. He's the only one who could have done it. We need to know why." She narrowed her eyes at me and then turned to her son. "Your foolishness is catching up with you, Philip. Mr. Gant is also a fool. He killed the wrong one." "What?" Weatherly gasped. "Don't be an idiot," she snapped. Mr. Gant is protecting the thing. She turned back to me. Young man, Mr. Gant will undoubtedly discover his error. She wheeled and walked away into the darkness. Ben and hissed. He meant to kill you. I'm trying to remember what we said while he was in the room. He knows that you and someone else are here to help the professor get rid of it. But you were sitting next to Judd when he mentioned it. That means he'll be coming after you next. We've got to find him, Weatherly whined. He could ruin everything. I gave him a disgusted look. But he didn't really mean it the way it came out. I'll wake Dad, I said. Poe came back into the hall looking a little sick, and the professor went to him. Mom and Dad were both asleep. Tanny was on a daybed screwed up like a worm, the way she always slept. I put my hand on Dad's shoulder and his eyes popped open. He started to say something, but I put my finger to my lips and motioned him to come outside. He got out of bed, careful not to wake Mom, and put on his robe, looking at me questioningly. In the hall, we explained everything that had happened. Do you think Linda and your mother will be safe? Poe asked. Wake Linda and put her with Mom, and stay with them, and bolt the door. She nodded. Poe was worried. Don't tell Linda what happened to Judd, not yet. He went back in his room and closed the door. Professor, I said, you know the house. Where could he be hiding? He shook his head. I don't know. Lots of places. I suggest we start downstairs and work up to the attic. Ben, can you read him at all? No. We started in the cellar and searched every hiding hole. He wasn't down there, and he wasn't on the ground floor either. Dad had his flashlight and had one of the kerosene lamps, so we could split up when necessary to prevent Gant from doubling back on us. Poe had a poker he took from the parlor fireplace. He grinned at me nervously and smacked it a couple of times in his palm. We went back downstairs. Dad shined the flashlight down the hall. Gant was at the door of Mom's room, crouched over the doorknob. He had a large butcher knife in his hand. He looked up at us and ran off in the opposite direction through a door. When we got to it, it was locked. That's the stairway to the attic, Weatherly said. Dad rattled the door a few times, frowning at it. It had one of those old mortise-type locks that could be locked from either side, but only with a key. Wait a moment, Weatherly muttered. The lock rattled and went snick. The door swung open about 2 inches with a lazy creak. Dad glanced at Weatherly, then opened the door the rest of the way. He pointed the flashlight up the steep, narrow steps, but there was nothing except gloom and cobwebs. Dad took a deep breath and started up very cautiously. Poe was behind him with the poker, then the professor. I brought up the rear with a kerosene lamp. The stairs entered the attic through a hole in the middle of the floor, a perfect place to get your head knocked off when you poked it up. Dad shined the light around, keeping down as far as he could, ready to duck if Gant was waiting. When he motioned the rest of us up, I realized I'd been holding my breath. The attic was a jumble of discards and had a 50-year accumulation of dust. The floor was velvety smooth, disturbed only by Mr. Gant's footprints, leading into the pile of rubble and little stitchery-like marks made by crawling beetles. Dad followed Mr. Gant's footprints with a flashlight beam, but we couldn't see him. 20 people could have been hiding in all the clutter. I held the lamp high, trying to see into the darkness. It was practically useless. It lit everything beautifully, for 3 feet in every direction. And when one of us moved, he cast a shadow, the size of Godzilla. The rafters were draped with dusty cobwebs and spotted with little brown mounds made by Mod Dabbers. The flashlight passed over a wasp nest the size of a dinner plate back in the corner. The yellow jacket stirred sluggishly, lethargic in the cool night air. Dad kept swinging the flashlight around, covering as much of the attic as he could, but Mr. Gant was invisible to my eyes as he was to my mind. He could have been hiding in any one of many places. I was about to suggest we lock the attic securely and leave Mr. Gant to the spiders when something toppled behind me. We whirled in that direction. The flashlight caught Mr. Gant, charging straight at us with the butcher knife drawn back. The whole thing couldn't have taken more than a couple of seconds, but I suddenly had a sensation of slow motion, of Gant running at me through a narrow aisle between stacks of cardboard boxes, of the knife glinting in the flashlight beam, of his shirt flaring at each step. I remembered studying his face. Remember feeling surprised that it was almost emotionless, surprised that he wasn't slavering like a madman. All of this must have been only in my mind, because my muscles didn't correspond. I just stood there like a dummy, watching him. Then he tripped, his toe caught in a picture frame leaning against a stack of boxes. A startled expression crossed his face as his body got ahead of his feet. Instead of getting me with a knife, he rammed into me bodily. My arms went up, and the lamp slipped smoothly from my fingers. I grunted as the wind was knocked out of me. Then Gant and I landed on the floor in a tangle, but the lamp stayed in my line of vision, arching up slowly, very slowly. The thin glass chimney hit a rafter and shattered. Then the base, the wick still burning, smashed against the trunk, engulfing one end of the attic and burning kerosene. Mr. Gant lost no time in getting himself untangled. He had landed on top. I was flat on my back. The next thing I knew, he was straddling my stomach with a knife drawn back. I twisted as he brought the knife down, and I heard it thunk into the floor beside my ear. Then good old Post swung the poker with both hands, as if he were chopping wood. It caught Mr. Gant across the shoulders. He yelled and arched his back, his face twisting with pain. He lurched up, gasping for breath, and staggered into the darkness, the knife still in his hand. He upset several piles of uncertain junk, bringing them down with a clatter. Poe and Dad helped me up, and I grinned thanks at Poe. Mr. Gant was out of sight again, hidden by the darkness and the smoke. We turned to the fire. The whole end of the attic was burning furiously. The heat was rapidly becoming uncomfortable. We edged toward the stairs, but the professor was staring at the flames deep in concentration. We stopped and watched. A mist began forming in the attic, like a heavy fog rolling in. It even smelled like fog. It grew thicker and thicker, closing in on the fire until finally it was completely obscured by the bank of white. The crackle of the flames gradually changed to a damp hissing, then nothing. I could no longer feel the heat. Little beads of water stood on the hairs on my arms like a heavy dew. The thick mist swirled away as if in a wind, and the fire was out. The end of the attic was blackened and charred, shiny with moisture. Drops of water fell from the rafters, thumping against the boxes and trunks and other debris. Weatherly sighed deeply. "You're sure handy to have around, Professor," Post said with a certain amount of awe. "Carnival tricks," he parished, the thought. Dad swung the flashlight away from the burnt area and started to say something. He stopped with his mouth open, looking at something. We turned. Gant was creeping toward us with a knife in his hand. Mr. Gant may have had his faults, but lack of determination wasn't one of them. He stopped when the light hit him. His eyes glittered like marbles. Weatherly was concentrating again. I heard a harsh buzzing, and the wasp nest almost directly over Gant's head erupted in a yellow and black storm. I don't know what Weatherly did, but the yellow jacket swarmed all over Gant. He screamed and stumbled back, crashing through a pile of discards, swatting at the singing insects. He kept yelling and threshing, and I guess Weatherly couldn't go through with it any longer, because the wops left Gant and settled back on the nest. Then unbelievably, Gant rose from the junk and started toward us again. His face and hands were solid with welts that grew redder and larger by the second. One eye was almost closed, but he came at us, staggering and stumbling, entangling himself in the clutter. He warded off the collapsing debris with one hand and held the knife in the other. Professor Weatherly groaned. Then the knife in Gant's hand glowed a cherry red. Gant sucked air through his teeth and dropped it, clutching his hand with the other. The knife clattered to the floor. A curl of smoke rose from it, but before another fire could get started, Weatherly did something to it, and it was cold once more. Dad kept a flashlight on Gant. He backed away, still hunched over his burned hand. He moved toward him. His eyes was now completely closed, and the other didn't look too good. He still hadn't given up. He grabbed the base of a piano stool with his good hand and drew back to throw it. Then he froze. The piano stool slipped from his fingers and bounced off a three-legged table. Gan sucked in air like a fish. He clutched at his chest. I looked at Weatherly, then back at Gant. He breathed in great roaring gas, tearing at his shirt. He dropped to one knee, then doubled up and fell sideways into a rusty birdcage. He didn't move. We went to him. He was unconscious, but breathing evenly. I looked at Weatherly. You could have killed him. Yes. What do we do with him now? Dad asked softly. The professor didn't answer for a moment, then looked up. The closet in the upstairs has a strong lock on it. So we wrestled Gant down the narrow stairs and locked him in the empty closet. The lock didn't seem to be any stronger than any of the others, but it worked and wasn't loose. The door opened outward, but there wasn't enough room for Gant to get much of a run at battering it down. If he tried, we would hear him. We propped a chair under the knob just in case and stood there looking at each other. Now what? Poe finally said, plucking stray cobwebs from the hair on his chest. Everyone should go back to bed. There's nothing more to be done, the professor said. Dad brushed dust from his robe. How long do you plan to wait before you attempt to send your monster back where it came from? Weatherly glanced at me, then looked morosely at Dad. I don't know, he sighed. Tomorrow in the daylight, after everyone's rested? I don't know, he glanced at me again. We must make sure everything is right. I doubt it will have a second chance. He looked at the floor, then back at Dad. I'm terribly sorry all of you were involved in this, Mr. Henderson. Mr. McNeil, terribly sorry. He turned and walked slowly towards a chair. Claire and Linda will be very curious about all this commotion, Dad observed. Don't tell Linda until the morning about Judd, Poe said in a strained voice. She needs sleep. Anne has already satisfied your curiosity, I explained. We moved Judd's body downstairs to the dining room and covered it with a sheet. None of us could think of anything else to do. Then we went back to bed. I don't know how long I've been asleep. I'm not at my most lucid when suddenly awakened. I found myself sitting in the middle of the bed wondering what woke me. Then I knew. I ran into the hall barefooted and in my underwear. The closet door was wide open. I never found out how Gant got it open without waking someone. I should have known his determination wouldn't have been dampened by a single locked door. I burst into Anne's room without slowing and skidded to a halt. Gant had his arm around her throat so she couldn't cry out. They stood near the foot of the bed. Anne was fighting him, but he was too strong for her. He had gone back to the attic for the knife and held it at her breast. His face and hands looked like raw hamburger. He didn't even look at me, though I imagined he could barely see. His good eye was almost swollen shut, but he was lost in some fantasy of his own, and I thought I could detect an expression of rapture on his swollen face. He wasn't holding Anne as a shield or a hostage, but as a sacrifice. I stood petrified in the middle of the room as he drew back the knife. My face contorted in rage and hate, and I screamed a silent mental scream. I don't know exactly what I did, and I've never tried to repeat it. I drew on something I hope never emerges again. My mind raged at Gant, blasted him with primal hate. Synapses opened like floodgates, the knife froze in the air. My fingernails dug into my palms. My body trembled uncontrollably. Sweat popped out of my face. My eyes locked on his. The arm around Anne's neck fell away. The knife slipped from his upraised hand. He took a step backward, staring at me uncomprehendingly with his red slit of an eye, his mouth slack. Anne stumbled away from him and got behind me. I didn't stop because Anne was free. The vision of the knife buried in her breast was too vivid. I could have rationalized it as the only way, but I wasn't thinking at the time, only hating. Gant backed against the wall, but his legs kept moving, trying to get him farther away. His head jerked back and forth, as if he wanted to loosen something clinging to his face. He put his red puffy hands over his ears and breathed through his mouth. A low moan began deep in his throat. The moan grew slowly in volume and pitch until it was a shrill keening, ending only when his lungs were empty. I hammered at the bright mirror surrounding him, beat at it, battered against it until it shattered, and I plunged through into his mind. I thought I screamed, but Anne said later it was a whimper. I threw up my shields and fought my way out, ripping and tearing, clawing my way free, slashing through the bright chaos and blinding disorder of Gant's mind. As I broke free, I felt his mind dim and go black. I felt like jelly and slumped to my knees. I couldn't get my breath. My arms hung limp and immovable. Gant was in a crumpled heap against the wall. Anne was beside me, kneeling beside me, her arms around me, feeling me. Our heartbeat began. Oh, Ben. Yes, my dear, do you know what I did? I felt it. Part of it reflected off his shield. Are you all right? Did he hurt you? No, I was only frightened you came. We can do it now. No, not now. Later. Yes. The heartbeat continued. They're all still asleep. Yes, I never thought it could be so. I know, I know. I keep forgetting. Anne, I know. Don't be sad. We've lost something, but we've gained more. So very much more. The heartbeat ended. I put my arm around her. She leaned her head against mine, and we went to my room. I closed the door behind me and leaned against it, looking at her. She stepped toward me. I met her halfway. We kissed, melded in mind and body. We undressed and moved to the bed, touching and loving. It wasn't only physical love, but I wasn't reading her. It was no longer necessary. I was me. I was Anne. We were us. When the sun came up, we got out of bed and dressed. I went to my parents' room. Anne went to Poe and Linda's. Dad, Mom, we said. Poe, Linda, we said. Wake up, get dressed, and ready to leave. Pack everything and go out on the porch. Ben, Mom said. Anne? Linda said. Everything is okay, we said. We're ready to help the professor get rid of his monster. Hurry. Anne and I met in the hallway and went downstairs. Professor Weatherly was asleep on the couch, tired and gray, slipping into despair. Professor, we said with my voice. What? He sat up suddenly confused. Oh, Ben, is it morning? Yes. We're ready, the Anne part of me said. What? He stood up, rubbing his eyes. We're ready to help you exorcise your monster. He looked at us. Something has happened. Yes, Anne and I are telepathically linked. It's permanent. Describe it to me. I'm not sure I can. I know everything Ben's thinking. I remember. I feel everything he feels. But there's more than that, I said. I'm both of us, and we're one of us. We're, well, essentially we're one person in two bodies, yet we still retain our separate egos. Perhaps a better explanation would be we're two people cohabiting two bodies. I don't know how it would be with two men or two women, but with us it's love. Yes, he whispered. Yes, it would have to be, wouldn't it? Total love or total loathing. There could be no other way. There's no way, really, to know what it's like without experiencing it, Anne said. People who know only physical love are missing so much. We grinned, though I guess there is something faintly masturbatory about it. This is absolutely marvelous, he beamed like a child on Christmas morning. Will you allow me to study this further? We smiled at him. Of course, Professor, I said. As soon as the others are ready to leave, we can contact your monster. Your mother will not leave. Mr. Gant is dead. Dead? He blinked. I killed him, I said. I locked my muscles to stop the trembling I could feel about to begin. I willed him dead, and he died, I said numbly. Anne put her hand on my shoulder. We're ready, she said. Vocalizing was slow and clumsy, but it was an old habit. Wait here, I told him, and went to the entry hall. They came down the stairs with their suitcases and uncertain expression. Linda crying, but trying to stop. Poe had told her about Judd. I herded them, unresisting, onto the porch. Mom and Dad turned and looked at me, frightened. I smiled. Don't worry, I said. Tanny peeked at me, saucer-eyed and solemn. I winked at her. She grinned and went on out. I closed the door and went back to the parlor. Are you ready? Yes, Weatherly nodded. I hope what you find out justifies everything, Professor. We concentrated. A brilliant flash, a sheet of energy swirled around us, held away by the professor, and died out. Take it easy, I said softly. Take it easy. It's almost insane with fright. We touched that alien mind, not entered, only touched. We could have been lost if we had entered. Its alienness was indescribable. There was no point of reference to human thought. We stared in awe at its great, shining, immature mind. Its alienness made details, even large details, impossible to grasp, but basic emotions, which must be common to all intelligent life, were clear to read. It was aware of our minds, but did not fear them. It feared only what was alien to it, Weatherly's physical assault. A smile came involuntarily to our lips. I'll be damned, I said aloud. Do you know what we've got, Professor? It's a baby. if that's the right word. Its memory goes back millions, billions of years. So far it can't remember its origin, but it knows it's immature. The reason it's never left this house is that it's basically a frightened child. It wants only to go home. Send it back, Professor, while I try to keep it calm. Another flash and another swirl of energy. It's too frightened, I said anxiously. I'm having trouble. It wants to go home more than anything, but you'll have to force it. It's irrational with fear. It's been here only a moment by its time scale. And left to get the others to the cars away from the house. I waited until they were at a safe distance. Now force it, Professor. Energy whirled around us like a tornado. The walls, the ceilings, the floors, the furniture, all were burning fiercely, except for the bubble in which we stood. Weatherly opened a path through the inferno, a path from us to the door. Go with the others, Ben, he said. I started to protest, but he shut me up. You can do just as much from outside as you can in here, and I can do more if I don't have you to worry about. He was right. I had no protection from the thing's physical energy. Energy which I suspected was manifesting itself physically because it was here, not where it came from. I ran through the tunnel he opened and turned at the door. The tunnel closed, and I couldn't see him anymore. I hurried down the hill to the others, still in contact with the professor's monster. The just-risen sun gleamed on the still damp house, turning the weathered gray to copper, but flames poured from the parlor windows. Smoke billowed from other openings, the gray clouds also gilded by the sun. Flames suddenly spurted from under the eaves. The fire had gotten upstairs. Energy popped like lightning bolts. All this I saw with my eyes and heard with my ears. What I saw and heard with my mind was different. I caught a thought from the professor's mother, but shut it out quickly, unable to bear it. The monster threshed in the professor's grip, frightened out of its mind, screaming pitifully. I watched Professor Weatherly in the parlor, but not with my eyes. He stood in a clear island surrounded by raging flames and energy. It began. The inferno cycloned away on one side of him, and a tunnel opened. An endless gleaming tunnel. He stood still, hunched in concentration. I knew, suddenly, what was about to happen. But the professor was caught completely by surprise. There was nothing I could do to help him. I slammed shields around Anne. She jerked out of her trance and looked wildly about. She screamed at me, "No, Ben, don't block me out!" More energy popped. Everyone's clothing clung to their skin. I could feel my hair standing up, charged with static electricity. Helplessly, I watched the professor force his monster into the tunnel. He hadn't moved. He stood before the tunnel, surrounded by an inferno, hunched in concentration. Then gradually, slowly, his body smudged outward toward the tunnel. He felt it. He looked up. He strained away from the tunnel, held out his arms, warding it away. The distortion, the stretching outward, continued. His arms were caught in it, extending to half again their former length, blurring toward the tunnel. Then a particle of his little finger broke away and streamed down the tunnel like a shooting star. More particles broke free. The tunnel was filling with shooting stars, streaking to infinity. I threw up my shield. Weatherly's terror was too great, but in that last split second, I saw Comet roar away down the tunnel, and he was gone. The tunnel was closing. I was aware of physical sensations only. I stood swaying, trying to keep from toppling over. Anne threw her arms around me. Dad put his hand on the back of my neck, not saying anything. I dropped the shields. Anne and I were one again. "He did it," I said on an exhaustion high. "It's gone home. He sent it back. But it dragged him back with it." I was with him for a moment. The energy was gone, but the fire wasn't. The old wood of the house burned ferociously. Dad propelled us away to the bottom of the hill where the others waited numbly. We stood for a long time, saying nothing, watching the house burn. Tanny had come to me and stood watching the house with her arm clutching my thigh. I had my arm on her shoulder. "What about you, Anne?" Dad asked. "With me," I said. "Yes," she smiled. Tanny peeked around me, staring at Anne. Anne smiled at her and winked the same way I would. Tanny grinned like a supernova. She launched herself at Anne and hugged her. The sheriff's car pulled up as we were about to leave. He was a nice person named Robin Walker. We told him a simplified version of what happened, a version he could believe. And I made sure he believed it. Dad backed the station wagon out of the ditch. I got in the yellow VW with Ann, and we went to Wichita.